You fellas want to read me my rights?
You have the right to have your face kicked in by me. You have the right to have your balls stomped by him.
I'll waive my rights.
They're pretty simple. The forms are all standard, boilerplate.
Okay, well, we're all hungry. We're gonna get to our hot plate soon enough, all right? But let's talk about the contract here.
Sorry.
You'd be surprised how many doors a letter from a lawyer can open or close.
It seems like you're talking slower since you started charging by the hour.
What's the meaning of this? This is my quiet time.
We're gonna have to take you into custody.
That's outrageous. What am I charged with?
Don't have to tell you anymore. Clearly haven't been reading your Scalia.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode number 200.
Woo!
How are you doing, Andrew?
I am fantastic. I mean, obviously, we do our shoeshine inspired numerology bit, but I am so, like, I'm just thrilled that we got to 200 episodes.
Yeah,
of the show,
yeah.
Man. Like,
tell you what, I know we said we weren't going to do gifts, but I got you something for you and the listeners. I impeached Donald Trump. It's over. I thought, you know, 200 episodes, it's the least I could do. So Donald Trump is impeached. We've ended Yodel Mountain. You're welcome. I hope it's a good gift. No, I guess that's not really in my power. I tried. I did everything I could. I wrote, but it's not there.
I was going to say, I usually get you alcohol. So I don't know which one's a better gift to you, but they're both good.
I think you need one or the other, I guess, is what. I didn't get you anything. Sorry. But I tell you what I did get you is a nice episode of Opening Arguments. And by that, I mean, you're going to give us a nice episode of Opening Arguments. What are we going to talk about today? We can talk about, I tell you what, I got you some nice, sort of good election results. How about that?
That was okay. Yeah. You know, that works.
Definitely me. I did it. We're going to talk about that. And we're going to talk about what we teased last week a little bit, which was what the House is going to look like post Chris Collinsworth, because I guess he had Chris Collins. And we're also going to talk about the Free Flow of Information Act 2017. I don't know if that's a good thing or if that's one of those ominous doublespeak titles for something. I'm not actually sure.
Well, you have to listen and find.
Yeah, I know. That's, I'm going to do the teaser. Is that an actual good thing, or is it a bill that allows Trump supporters to beat up journalists or something? Because honestly, who knows at this point? And finally, more on 3D guns. So there's a bit more. We got a lot of listener questions about that. So Andrew's going to take us back on another trip toward the apocalypse when every kid is carrying a 3D printed gun. So. Can't wait for that.
way to kind of take us right into depressing.
It's episode 200. Right, depressing mark. You for 200 episodes. No, it's more like depressing you for like 175 episodes. How many? We got a few in there while I was still, you know, like things were looking good and we were happy. It's at least 100 episodes of solid depression. But don't blame us. Blame the world. So let's do it.
Yeah. All right.
Political. So yeah, Ohio 12. Now, I don't know if this will be officially solidified by the time you're hearing this. I mean, it feels like with a margin as slim as it is, last I saw, it was like, I don't know, 1,700 votes or something, that, you know, that it is a situation where possibly some absentee ballots or some whatever still could be, you know, could change things. But what's your impression? Is it solid yet?
Yeah, two things. So number one, I did the math on the outstanding ballots because of course I did.
Right. Right.
So Ohio 12 background. This is a PVI of R plus seven. So this is a 7-point Republican district. The Cook Political Report was, as far as I know, the only place they changed this race to a toss up. 3 weeks ago. Everybody else had this as a lean Republican special election. And it is, in fact, separated by 1,754 votes out of 1,483 remaining, which are 5,000 mail-in and absentee ballots and 3,435 provisional ballots. Provisional ballots tend to be overwhelmingly Democratic. Here's the bottom line.
What is a provisional ballot? Am I dumb for not knowing that?
No, you're not dumb at all, right? So what happens is, because of redistricting, because of gerrymandering, oftentimes people's polling places get changed. You get drawn into another district when you should have been in, you know, and so, you know, you're like, oh yeah, I always vote at, you know, this middle school every year, and you don't realize that you've been drawn into another district. And so you show up at a polling place that is not.
And they
your
give you like a
place.
Cocktail napkin. You write down your votes and then they mail it over to the other.
They are required by state law to give you a provisional ballot.
I see.
And then they hold on to that ballot. And what they do is they make sure they check for fraud, right? So that you don't run around to 13 different polling places and vote in all of them. But if you are validly registered and you are within casting the votes in elections for which you were qualified to cast your votes, right? Like, so if you're outside a congressional district, they won't let you cast a ballot. You know, if you move from the 3rd to the 8th congressional district, you can't cast the congressional ballot. But obviously, you can still cast statewide offices. And if you're within the district, you can cast, but you've just gone to the wrong polling place, which also happens, right? So that you don't have to be zoned outside the district. You can just not show up at the place that has you on the voter list. So then they hold on to the ballots, and then they use those ballots in elections like this that are close. And those tend to be overwhelmingly Democratic. So the Republican is Troy Balderson.
Right.
Fantastic Republican name. Baldy McBalderson. I actually don't even think he's bald, but
he should be.
Yeah, right. I would shave my head if my last name were Balderson.
I might change my name to change the name to Troy Harrison, just to be more positive.
The Democrat is Danny O'Connor. This race was not on anyone's radar. He's going to have to win 60.4% of the outstanding ballots. And I think that is incredibly unlikely. And let me add that I don't know that this much matters, right? Because this race
is right back up in November.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. And the two candidates will go at it again in November. And the way in which I look at it is, it's possible, but the voter enthusiasm gap is magnified in special elections as opposed to regularly scheduled elections. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to imagine. Things could get demonstrably worse for the Republicans in the next couple of months. That's a possibility. But assuming that they just remain bad for Republicans, but not catastrophic, I think this seat is going to change hands. Again, you made this point on SIO. Barring that, I think the very likely result is Balderson is going to win this special election and then is going to win re-election in the fall in the general regularly scheduled election. And part of that is, right, he's going to be the incumbent congressman. And, you know, it's only for a couple of months, but that conveys a well-demonstrated advantage when you're running. And, you know, in a race that's this close, every advantage is going to count.
I was going to ask a technical quick question because they keep saying, oh, they're just going to run again in November. And I'm just wondering, like, do they have to do another primary thing, or is it just like, because it's so close to November, they're just the same two people? But theoretically, you know, does it have to be that way, or do they have to go through a whole nother primary for November?
I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, I keep wondering every time people say, well, they're just going to run again. And it probably doesn't matter because I'm sure it would just be the same two candidates regardless. But I was kind of curious about that. But anyway, no big deal.
So We didn't prep this question, so I don't fully know the answer, but let me take my best guess at this, right? Which is, it is not impossible to appear on a ballot twice. And so for this, which coincides with the primary election, to for these candidates to be running as the primary nominee for the general election and also as the candidates in the special election.
Okay.
So I would be shocked if there is another primary in between
August
and November. But you can appear on the ballot twice. The other option is that there could have been an earlier primary, and that primary was applied to both the special election and the general election. But it varies state by state. I mean, that the case that immediately came to mind is when Arnold Schwarzenegger was first elected in California, the recall effort to recall Gray Davis was on the ballot. And so you had kind of this weird situation where the lieutenant governor, Cruz Bustamante, was running to win in the recall election, but was also on the ballot for no on the recall, right? He was the sitting lieutenant governor, right? So you see that happen. You see this also happen in special elections where candidates will have as their theme, you know, punch the ballot twice. So that's what I suspect is going on. Feel free, write in, tell me if Andrew was wrong, because I do want to know. No, it's a great question, but that's what I think. So Donald Trump went, you know, took to Twitter and said, "Hey, I'm 5 for 5." You know, that's typical Trumpism. I mean, I think
he definitely. Yeah. But okay.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you don't count the ones I've lost, you don't count Doug Jones in Alabama, hey, I went down to Alabama and lost that is not exactly, you know, what you want to tweet home about. I think you covered this really, really well on SIO. I forget. I don't know if you know which number it was offhand.
I don't know what you're talking about. What did I cover?
The Democratic performance in special elections, right? So
that was like a year ago, right? That was a long time ago.
It was after the last high profile before Doug Jones. I keep an encyclopedia like index of SIO because it's that good. No, seriously, like you have to look at the underlying structural conditions. I pulled up, I'll link in the show notes, the Cook Political Report, shows that, in the last, 9 special elections, Democrats have outperformed their expected share of the vote by 8 points. And Charlie Cook, who's one of the very best in the business, says if that pattern were extrapolated out in the fall, Democrats would pick up 81 seats in Congress. That's not going to happen, right?
Even through gerrymandering? My impression was that they already had to make up like 6 or 7% just on gerrymandering. I'm surprised that would lead to that many.
So that's the thing, right? That if you add 8 points across the board, it shifts 81 seats. You're not going to get 8 points across the board because the incumbency effect subtracts from that. Democrats need to flip 23 Republican seats. So, you know, they're not going to pick up.
But I just remember saying the point I made back on that episode, which feels like forever ago, so I don't even remember. But one point I made is that everybody seemed to be. I was frustrated by how much people were like, "Well, none of it matters because the Democrat ultimately lost still." You know, and it frustrated me because it seems to me that one seat isn't going to make a difference anyway. So this idea that it's like, well, if doesn't matter how much ground they make up in the polling, if you still fall short, even though it's like the reddest of red districts, if you still fall short and lose, you haven't gained anything. And my point was like, even if they won, it doesn't do anything. You know, it's one House seat. It doesn't make these special elections make no actual difference yet because it's not going to swing the balance of power. You know, we need to swing a lot more seats. So my point was all this is basically symbolic. And if you're looking at the symbolic victory, it's the fact that, you know, we've gained 8 or 9 points. You know, we've almost changed R+7 to a toss up. And I feel like that's a victory.
Yep. I think that is exactly right. And so that's what I would encourage, right? We're beginning with some good news, and I think that's a really nice segue into our main segment.
All right, let's do it.
Yeah. So I want to talk about you tease this in the intro. This is a good piece of legislation, or at least it's a very interesting piece of legislation. We're going to go through it. That is languishing in the House of Representatives right now. It is the Free Flow of Information Act of 2017. It was sponsored by Jamie Raskin, who is a Maryland Democrat in the House of Representatives. Somebody I've met.
See, because, you know, I wouldn't have been surprised if this was just introduced now to try to get like Alex Jones back on the air. That would be. I wouldn't have been surprised either way. Honestly, you could have told me this is the best piece of legislation or just a ridiculous doublespeak piece of legislation. But
yeah, okay, no, so we do have. And let's be fair, right? Like that Orwellian language is something that, you know, both sides do, right? That's not that is not limited. This legislation, we're gonna get into the specifics, but it involves whether reporters have the right to keep their sources confidential. And so, as usual, it's Tuesday, and we test drove the time machine a little bit on Friday, but we're really gonna rev it up today. But before we get into it, right, think about, I mean, there's sort of two important philosophical principles that are at stake here, right? The first is the historical relationship between the press and democracy, right, as the fourth estate and an important check on majoritarianism and any originalist literature, anything you look at with respect to the founding fathers talks about the significance of a free press as really being essential to a democracy. And then let's layer on top of that the relationship between Donald Trump and the press, right? Donald Trump has threatened to jail journalists, right? He did so to James Comey. He has referred to reporters as scum. And he has, you know, as we've talked about on the show, engaged in a campaign to take an actual phenomenon of fake news and muddy the waters so much that, you know, Republicans now use fake news to refer to CNN. And,
you know we're at the point where the period of time which fake news was used incorrectly by Republicans is vastly longer than the 3 minutes that like NPR was using it to describe what was actually happening. Isn't that funny?
Yep.
The concept was instantly hijacked.
Yeah. And that's not, I mean, in my view, this is obviously a rabbit trail, but in my view, that is a design, right? That's not by accident, right? They looked at, and you know, the Breitbarts of the world have talked about this as an affirmative strategy of taking your biggest weakness and just co-opting the words until they no longer mean what they're supposed to mean. And that, you know, when I need to laugh instead of cry, I will quote, you know, that idiotic line from Donald Trump in the debates where, you know, Hillary Clinton accused him of being a puppet of Vladimir Putin, and he robotically repeated, no puppet, you're the puppet.
No puppet, you're the puppet.
I mean, what, you just cannot have, right, a more short circuit of the strategy on display there, right, which is take by all accounts appears to be a valid criticism and just reiterate and go, no, not me, you. In any event. So, you know, if you believe historically that protecting the press is important and that we are at a unique point in history, then now we would look to a question to see whether reporters should have a special kind of right that the average person doesn't get. And here's the way in which that comes about. Okay. If a normal person witnesses a crime, let's say they see a drug deal go down, right? And the police officer happens to watch you watch a drug deal go down, Thomas, and a police officer shows up at the scene, and just as you see the police arrive, you run into your house and slam the door. So now the police know you've seen this crime, and you take the view of, yeah, you know what? Like these drug dealers live on my street, and I don't want to get involved. It's not for me. The ordinary process is that the prosecutor can subpoena you, they can require you to show up in court and testify. And they're first going to call you up nicely and say, Mr. Smith, we're pretty sure you saw what went down. You're going to testify? And you say, I didn't see nothing. Nothing happened. I'm not going to testify.
I go all Vin Diesel then, on them is what happens if you've seen the latest, yeah. Or listen to the latest Lot Awful movies. Check it out.
Yeah. and so when you do that, then the next step, assuming that you're crucial to the case, is a very nice gentleman wearing a firearm will show up at your house and hand you a subpoena, and you will be required to go testify. And if you don't comply with that subpoena, you can be arrested. They will issue a bench warrant for your arrest for failure to comply with a valid warrant. Now,
and I assume if you go in and just say like, nah, I didn't see anything. My eyes were foggy. I don't know. It's just that they can charge you with something, obstruction or lying or,
but yeah, they can charge you with perjury, right?
Perjury. Yeah.
Or obstruction of justice and, or, if,
but like,
if
can they really prove that though? I mean, if you're just like, yeah, no, I was tired. I didn't see anything. Or is it just, that seems hard to prove that. I would know something.
It would in fact be hard to prove. And there are very few cases of going after witnesses, you know, in this case for perjury. But they could, right?
Okay.
They absolutely could do so. And in the extreme context, right, they could charge you as an accessory after the fact, right? They could say, no, you know where the drug dealer went. And by not telling us, you are in effect helping him complete his crime, right, after the fact. And again, these are unbelievably unlikely circumstances, but it is the ultimate consequence of what could happen to an average person. Now, let's talk about a reporter. Reporters tend to know about crimes, especially investigative reporters, especially really, really good investigative reporters. And the reason is because, reporters, have the opportunity to talk to people who are criminals as part of their investigative reporting, right? So, you know, imagine, for example, that you and I had the opportunity to bring on the show somebody who, under promises of anonymity, was going to talk about the inner workings of ISIS, right?
Hmm.
Now, that person has probably committed a crime. They certainly have knowledge of a crime, but I think you and I, as journalists, would say we would rather get out the message, find out what ISIS is thinking.
Good idea. Hit us up, ISIS.
Yeah. And we would rather disseminate that information to tens of thousands of listeners than, you know, have somebody call and immediately run, you know, to the police and go, a low-level ISIS person who may or may not have committed a crime just called me. And so, you know, so we would say we're going to sacrifice the justice in the individual case. We're going to make it harder to prosecute that one ISIS informant in order to protect the greater public interest of informing the public about what ISIS is doing. Right. And so ISIS informant calls us up and says, hey, I'll come on opening arguments, but you got to keep my name confidential. You got to protect my anonymity. And we say yes. And then they come on the show and they talk about crimes that they've witnessed. And then the police show up with a subpoena and say, okay, well, you happen to know who this guy is. He confessed to a crime on the air. Tell us who he is. And and you and I say, no, we're not going to tell you who he is.
Brian Ziegenhagen. Oh, sorry. What? Yeah, we say no.
We were not supposed to reveal that. We promised not to.
Yeah. Brian told us not to tell you that it's Brian is what we say. Got it.
Yes. Yes, exactly. This happens not every day, but if you start to read the literature a little bit, this happens more often than you might think. It happens with some regularity in which members of the press get a court order or a subpoena that compels the disclosure of the source's identity. And journalists will then say, no, First Amendment, freedom of the press. And for most of American history, journalists would attempt to rely on a reporter's privilege that's kind of like the lawyer's privilege, right? So same thing, right? Like if I have a client who comes to me and says, you know, as it turns out, right, I was the second shooter on the grassy knoll in Dallas in 1963, I am prohibited from ever telling anybody that without his permission, right? I can't break that confidence, even though I know the, you know, one of the most notorious criminals in history now, right? So I have information, but we've said the attorney-client privilege is going to supersede the truth value of providing that information. And the question is, do journalists have a similar privilege? And the answer is, at the Supreme Court level, no. No, they don't. And that case is a 1972 case. It's called Brandsburg versus Hayes. And all of this debate takes place. This is the first stop in our time machine, 1972. All of the debate takes place in the shadow of Brandsburg versus Hayes. That case consolidated a couple of cases involving journalists in two areas. One was a journalist who had infiltrated a drug ring. And again, because this is 1972, they were making hashish, which I don't know that anybody even makes. I don't know. I'm not a big drug guy, but there's a little bit of that anachronism. But basically, the journalist went to talk about to do investigative reporting on the problems of drugs in our city, and got, you know, one of the drug manufacturers sit down for an interview, took photos. And so what ran with his article was a photo of hands mixing together the hashish, right? And with the caption, you know, anonymous drug dealer makes hashish. The other journalist who was swept up in this had infiltrated the Black Panther Party. And the Black Panther Party had publicly televised speeches in which they threatened, quote, "We will kill Richard Nixon." That threat had been multiply repeated. And then they said, "We advocate the direct overthrow of the U.S. government by way of force and violence, by picking up guns and moving against it, because we recognize it as being oppressive. And in recognizing that, we know the only solution is armed struggle." And so in all of these cases, the police said, "Hey, you journalist have knowledge of crimes, and we want you to disclose the identity of your sources." And in all of those cases, the journalist said no. And it went all the way up to the Supreme Court. Wow. And the Supreme Court said, essentially, they gave two different arguments. They rejected it, right? They said, no, you don't have a privilege in the Constitution to refuse to disclose your sources. And they basically gave two lines of evidence. The first was, summarized by the quotation, "The public has the right to every person's evidence." Grand juries have to be able to function. The way they function is by issuing subpoenas. And, you know, calling yourself a reporter, like, that's fine, but you know, reporters don't get extra rights. Reporters are people. People have to comply with the subpoena, so you have to comply with the subpoena. And then there was a second, kind of more sophisticated argument that went alongside that, which said the publisher of a newspaper has no special immunity from the application of general laws. He has no special privilege to invade the rights and liberties of others. So the press is not free to publish with impunity anything and everything it desires to publish. So even if it's going to deter what's said and published, you may not, you know, for example, publish libel, right? You may not, they relied upon a case called Zemel versus Rusk, in which the Supreme Court upheld, once the Cuban embargo was put into place, journalists tried to get passports to go to Cuba and said, "Hey, look, you can't," and I get that, you know, the average person can't go to Cuba, but we need to go to Cuba because we're going to report what's going on in Cuba. And if you don't let us go, we won't be able to successfully report. And the Supreme Court said, yeah, this could have an incidental effect on the public's right to know about Cuba. But the law says nobody's going to Cuba. So your person, you're not going to Cuba. That was the argument in favor of the government. On the side of the reporters, their main argument is that without a shield, confidential sources won't talk to us. So, for example, this is what one commentator wrote in 2018. She says, "Reporters now fear that sources will stop coming forward with information integral to the free flow of information. Absent a framework in which members of the press can consistently protect their confidential information, sources will stop disclosing valuable information for fear of legal punishment, leaving journalists with less accurate and less timely facts to report to the public. This significantly burdens the news gathering process and effectively censors the press, which is entirely inconsistent with the First Amendment. But nevertheless, the Supreme Court wasn't having any of it. The Supreme Court said, look, we can think of at least six areas in which incidental regulations burden the press all the time. Right. So the press is excluded from, number one, grand jury proceedings. Grand jury proceedings are confidential and behind closed doors. Press doesn't get to go there. Number two, from the Supreme Court itself on occasions. Number three, from the meetings of other official bodies that are held behind closed doors in executive session. Number four, private sessions, private organizations. So, you know, when you and I plan the show for OA, the press, we have the right to exclude the press.
Oh, good.
Yeah, yeah, you're right.
I mean, because so, I've just got, you know, mountains of paparazzi outside, but glad to know that I'm within my rights to say sorry. We some things must be private. Hey, listeners, I need to cut in here real quick to tell you about our sponsors. First up, Sanebox. There was a mix-up with the URL. We've told you about Sanebox before a couple times. Go to sanebox.com/opening to get that offer, the 2 weeks free. Don't go to sanebox.com/OA. Again, mix up with the URL. Sorry about that, but make sure to check them out. Clean up that inbox. I know I have. Sanebox.com/opening is the URL. Did you know that 66% of men lose hair by age 35? Oh boy, that's coming up real fast for me. Here's the thing. When you start to notice hair loss, that means it's already too late because it's easier to keep the hair you have than to replace the hair you've lost. If you're like me and you've consumed a healthy diet of pop culture over the years, you might have thought that there's nothing you can do about hair loss, or all you can do is some weird solution or fake pill or something like that. Surprisingly, though, this isn't actually true. There are real prescriptions backed by science that help you keep the hair that you have. And 4hims.com connects you with real doctors for those medical-grade solutions to treat hair loss. I want to emphasize, this isn't snake oil or weird supplements that aren't regulated any kind. These are actual prescription solutions backed by science. And the best thing about 4hims is you can get access to all this without an awkward doctor visit where you have to tell the doctor about what you're going through. You can save the time and that awkwardness by going to 4hims.com, answer a few quick questions, and a doctor will review your answers and can prescribe you the products that you need. And then they are shipped directly to your door. This really is a great opportunity if you want to try to do something about hair loss. And they have other products as well that you should check out. So while supplies last, our listeners get a trial month of Hims for just $5 right now. See the website for full details. And this would cost hundreds of dollars if you went to the doctor or to a pharmacy. So go to 4hims.com/OA. That's FORHIMS.com/OA. That's 4hims.com/OA.
But you could see how, you know, we might have information that you could argue would be useful in, you know, a public right to know context. And, you know, it's okay to keep
us out. I would hope that we would have information that would be useful to people since we're now on episode 200 of our podcast.
Right. There you go.
Hopefully, occasionally, we've been a little useful.
Yeah. Number five, you can keep the press out of a crime scene. And number six, you can stop them from attending or publishing information about a trial if those restrictions are necessary to preserve the defendant's fair right to a fair trial. So the Supreme Court said, nope, sorry, reporters don't get this special privilege. This was a very, very divided opinion. And it was one of these that that only got to five votes through a concurrence from Justice Powell, which just to cut out the legal geekery here, nobody really knows what that concurrence means. It's been the subject of considerable debate for 45 years. And it also spawned a stirring dissent from Justices Potter Stewart, William Brennan, and Thurgood Marshall that argued for an absolute right of journalists to keep their sources confidential. So that was the state of the law in 1972. That was not the end of the story. in the aftermath of the Brandsburg decision, many states, and it is now up to 49 out of 50 states, passed state-level protections for journalists, right? They said, okay, look, the Constitution doesn't enshrine this protection into law. That's what the Supreme Court has said. But as we've talked about on the show, states are free to go beyond to give more protection than the U.S. Constitution. This is the infamous one-way ratchet. And so here we go back to the same commentator. This is Megan Shaw writing in a Law Review article for the
But I've always, sorry, let me pause you for a sec, because I've always wondered, this is always a question in my mind, because I, you know, I've learned that from opening arguments, and I understand the concept, but doesn't it kind of depend on which way you frame the right? Like, if you frame it the other way, as, you know, the public has a right to know the information about a crime, then the state couldn't go further and say, like, no, we don't. You know what I mean? Like, doesn't it always, couldn't it really go either way depending on which direction you frame the right?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. And, you know, typically the way in which a lawyer would break that down is by differentiating between rights that you can apply to the individual versus general principles that are being characterized in the language of rights, but really are about efficiency, right? So that's how I would tackle if you wanted to go beneath any kind of applicable federal standard, and we don't know what that would be, right, because of how the Brandsburg decision came out. But if you wanted to go beneath it and say, well, this protects the public's right to know, I think most lawyers in writing that brief would be comfortable in saying, look, the public's right to know is just a way of characterizing in rights language something that says we want to make it easier for prosecutors to do their job, or we want to make it easier for people collectively to get information about drug use in their city or whatever. And those are maybe worthy utilitarian goals, right? Like, but nevertheless, they are subordinate if there is an individual right, because that's the definition of what a right is, right? Like, a right says, we get that it would be a good thing for society to make me do X, but I have a claim to not do X. And, you know, kind of concomitant with that is, it's implied that if you were to force me to do X, that would be good for the majority, because otherwise, why would you want to force me to do it, right? Like, no, the government never wants to force you to do something that would be bad for, you know, society writ large. So that's kind of how you would tackle that, is the question of specificity of,
okay,
is this attributable to the individual, or is this something we're thinking about as, you know, maybe using the language of rights, but it's kind of vague once you kind of zoom in. And the good way to think about that is to apply our lessons on standing, right? Is to ask, you know, is this something where a person could bring a lawsuit and say, my right has been violated, right? Is there a bright line? So it's really, really easy to figure out if you have a journalist privilege, right? You can figure out how that right has been violated, right? I'm a journalist. I don't want to comply with this subpoena, and the law says I have to, or I get, you know, hauled off to jail. On the flip side, right? How would you define a public with the right to know about, you know, certain stories in the press, right? You know what I mean? It would be very, very difficult to draw that bright line to say, okay, well, you know, I got this much information, but not that much information. You know what I mean? It's tough to sort of say, here's where the violation occurred.
Gotcha.
But again, these debates really do take place, right? So I don't mean to suggest that it is cut and dried, but that is, I think, the ground upon which that debate would take place. I will tell you that as a practical matter, now, either through state Supreme Court jurisprudence, that's 10 states, or by statute, that's 39 more states and the District of Columbia, 49 states and the District of Columbia now have some kind of privilege that allows journalists to protect the confidentiality of their sources. The only state that does not is Wyoming. So keep that one in mind.
Darn, that's too bad, because you know all the really hot news coming out of Wyoming that we... You know, there's just so much going on that they're probably just like, we don't even have journalists or anything. So who cares? Sorry.
Now,
sorry to everybody.
Now all our
from
Wyoming listeners are going to come at us.
Yeah. But. No, I this is interesting. I'm not sure if this is a good time, but I wanted to briefly kind of comment and ask you what you think about this, because this is one of those things where I kind of, maybe I do agree with the Supreme Court, because I don't know, from my understanding, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, I don't know that it would necessarily to make sense to say the journalists have a constitutional right to do this. But I think of it as kind of, I would think of it in more practical terms of, well, it's not as though this would happen otherwise. Like, picture a world in which journalists aren't allowed to keep sources private. Then what you would, it's not as though you would catch more criminals. You know what I mean? Like, my thinking is, in one scenario, you would catch the same number of criminals because people would just not go to journalists because they know they're not protected. And therefore, it's not as though you're catching any more criminals. Or you go to the other way, which is, well, people will know that they can go to journalists with interviews about, you know, ISIS or drugs or whatever it is, and be anonymous. And it'll be the same. Like, you'll probably catch the same number of criminals, except the public will have this useful and very interesting information from which to, you know, to be more informed about policy and stuff like that. So I look at it as a good, but I don't know that I would say, therefore, the Supreme Court should have ruled the other way, because I don't know that it necessarily, it seems like it maybe should be something that we do with legislation. What do you think?
So I really like the way you broke that down, because what you did was compare both worlds, right? Like, you're saying, in the world in which journalists have the right to keep their sources confidential, yes, people go to the journalists, and so we get the benefit of more information being disseminated to the public at the cost of the journalists then don't run to the police and give us information on criminals. But the alternative is not those people tell journalists, but then journalists immediately snitch on them. The alternative is those people don't tell the journalists and we don't get any more information. So I think you've correctly addressed sort of the utilitarian calculus here of, do you in fact get more criminal prosecutions in a world in which journalists don't get to keep their sources safe? And I think there is substantial doubt about that for precisely the reason that you've just described.
Yeah, it's like they're acting like journalists are going to act as undercover police officers for the police or something. It's like, that's not going to happen.
Yeah. And in fact, in the Powell concurrence, right? I mean, part of why it's so open to interpretation is that one of Powell's lines, a very, very short concurrence, and he's trying to kind of narrowly confine it to the facts. And he says, well, obviously, we're not going to allow the government to annex journalists as an arm of its prosecutorial wing. Right. And so, you know, so you look at it and you're like, oh, OK, well, you seem to recognize that this would be a problem. You know, where are you coming out? Right. So I think that's a really, really excellent point. And then the second question you asked is, just because something is desirable doesn't mean that you would find that right inherent in the Constitution. And that kind of brings us along to the question about, okay, so the Supreme Court passed, right? The Supreme Court said this isn't a right. That means two things can happen, right? Number one, states can supplement and make it a right in each state. There's a problem. There are, in fact, two problems with relying on states to do this, right? The first is the protections are wildly inconsistent from state to state. Mm. So, you know, now you create kind of this weird scenario of, you know, if I'm a journalist in X state, but then my subject is in Y state, right? You know, you don't know what's going to apply.
And then point two, what about federal crimes? Is that going to be put?
And that's exactly. And point two is, federal grand juries. And keep in mind, whistleblowers against the U.S. government, right? People who have the dirt on the government, exactly the kind of people that you think we want to have talking to journalists under protection of anonymity, have nothing. right? They have no unique protection. And so in recent years, right, I can think of at least two examples. I know there are more. In 2005, Judith Miller served 85 days in jail. She refused to testify in connection with the Valerie Plame investigation, if you remember when that was a thing. And then in 2014, in connection with the Jeffrey Sterling investigation, there was a journalist named James Risen who similarly refused to testify. He litigated and then ultimately he lost his case before the Fourth Circuit, appealed to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court denied cert. So he was sort of left twisting in the wind. And then ultimately the government decided to give up and not call him as a witness. But in prior cases, the government has said, yeah, no, sorry, we want you as a witness. We're going to go ahead and we're going to charge you with contempt. And, you know, and like I said, Judith Miller went to prison over this. And so the Risen case, I think, is underscores the fact that since Brandsburg, the Supreme Court has not taken these kinds of cases. In fact, in 45 years, they have only heard one case on reporter privilege, and they have just denied cert in every other case, right? So the result is that you have kind of this patchwork at the federal level where some circuits are more robust than others. Some circuits seem to say there's no right whatsoever. Some say there's kind of a qualified privilege. They're all sort of trying to fit into this Brandsburg decision that really isn't very clear and really doesn't give them a lot of guidance. And so when you have a federal investigation, right, you kind of have both of those harms, right? You have the if we're talking about potentially testifying in a state trial, it's going to vary state by state. But even in a federal trial, it's going to vary state by state based on which circuit you're under. And so that kind of brings us to H.R. 4382, which is the Free Flow of Information Act of 2017, which we teased at the beginning of the segment, that says it's meant to give you a uniform standard. And it says, in any matter arising under federal law, a federal entity may not compel a covered person, put a pin in that, to provide testimony or produce any document, that is, comply with a subpoena, related to information obtained or created by such covered person as part of engaging in journalism, unless a court determines by a preponderance of the evidence, after providing notice and an opportunity to be heard, three things. One, that the party seeking to compel production of such testimony, that is, the government, has exhausted all reasonable alternative sources other than the covered person. Two, that the information is, quote, critical to the prosecution and that the case meets certain important national security or other interests. And three, that the public interest in compelling the disclosure outweighs the public interest in gathering or disseminating news or information. So, you know, let's unpack that a little bit. This is not an absolute privilege, right? This says in instances of terrorism or serious crime or whatever, that may not meet those criteria. In cases where there's no other opportunity, there's no other avenue, the government can still issue a subpoena and require a journalist to testify. But it essentially takes the strict scrutiny approach and says, in the average garden variety case, in the Valerie Plame case, that no, we're not going to let, as a matter of first or intermediate resort, we're not going to let the government go to journalists and force them to turn over their sources. We're going to go only as a last resort, only if it's absolutely necessary. There's no other way to get it, and it meets these other criteria. And I think that, you know, that kind of strikes the right balance. Obviously, you know, folks can differ. To me, the really, really interesting question in terms of looking at this debate is the definition of what counts as a covered person, right? Who's a reporter under this statute? And the statute defines covered person as, quote, a person who regularly gathers, prepares, collects, photographs, records, writes, edits, reports, or publishes news or information that concerns local, national, or international events or other matters of public interest for dissemination to the public, for a substantial portion of the person's livelihood or for substantial financial gain, and includes, you know, supervisors, employers, parents, subsidiaries, or affiliates of such covered persons. So in English, it means you have to do this for a living. You have to make money at it, or you have to devote a substantial portion of your livelihood to it, even if you're not making a lot of money. This has to be your job. So think about what that means from the purpose of the statute, right? It means covers NBC, CNN, Fox News. It means it covers us, right? It means it covers Alex Jones. But it means it does not cover J random blogger, right? It does not cover somebody. It's Blank Bachman.
Blank Bachman joke. J random blogger did some good coverage on Blank Bachman. Right. Definitely indispensable.
But think about it, right? Like, are we now drawing the line that says a professional blog, right? Like, I bet, I don't know the answer, but, you know, I bet, you know, that now the Drudge Report is probably a substantial portion of Matt Drudge's income. When he first broke onto the scene, was that a substantial portion of his income, right? I don't know. Do we want to say that somebody who is a citizen activist, there used to be a Maryland state politics blog that was run by someone who then left to go work for a campaign. But it was the best source on local Maryland politics, and it was something that he did as a labor of love, right? Like, it was not commercial. It was not a substantial portion of his livelihood. Wouldn't be covered. And so I think, we could go 6 hours on the present face of journalism, but to me, you know, that's really kind of the linchpin question here when you're figuring out, you know, okay, let's solve the philosophical question: who should we protect? How should we go about protecting them? And then, you know, let's sort of get into the weeds, right? We say, okay. If we've come to the conclusion as a philosophical matter that we want to protect the confidentiality of reporter sources, does it make sense to have a rule that protects Alex Jones but doesn't protect a civic-minded public servant? You know, I don't know if we can answer that on this show, but I certainly thought it was worth opening this up for discussion. And again, all of this is moot, you know, under the current Republican Congress. But
it seems like a good bill to me anyway, and maybe if we retake the House here in a few minutes, then it could go somewhere. I mean, it's not going to get signed, but it'd at least be a bigger deal.
Yeah, look, I agree with you, right? I certainly think that having a uniform standard and recognizing the principle is better than the patchwork that we have now. I just want to point out the continuing sort of nuances to this debate as we're thinking about it. But you're right. I mean, you kind of cut to the punchline. You have to have a political system in place that cares about these issues, right? And, you know, that kind of brings us, I think that's a nice wrap up of full circle back to, we have an administration that is uniquely hostile to the press, certainly in modern times. And you know, being able to move away from that, being able to start discussing these issues of the relationship between the press and government again, I think would be incredibly beneficial to the country. So, that's another. If you're wondering about another reason to go out, you're on the far left and you're not enthused about the corporatist Democrat that won their primary in your area, and you're thinking about voting third party or staying home, another good reason to take the House is we can start talking about these things again. So.
Yep. Well, we're going to do it. Let's do it. Let's take the House. And furthermore, let's Beto O'Rourke the Senate. Let's take the
there
Senate.
There you go.
Well.
If Beto O'Rourke is down by 6 points now in the RCP average, if that gets down to 2 or 3 points, then all of a sudden the chance that the Democrats retake the Senate becomes a real possibility. So,
get voting, everybody.
There are some more people with missing chromosomes who ought to be thrown screaming from a helicopter. As Charlton Heston famously said, from my cold dead hand, you sons of bitches, this far and no further with your damn dictatorship.
Did you know that hammers kill more than guns?
Oh yeah, I'm a gun enthusiast.
Okay, so more stuff on 3D printed guns. What do we got?
Yeah, a bunch of folks asked us a lot of things, and obviously every time we do a guns episode, we get some comments and controversy, and you know, I like that. Something that came up on multiple occasions was whether we had seen the Electronic Frontier Foundation's take. I'm going to link that in the show notes, and I thought it would be worth talking about it because I have seen it, I have been through it. It does not change my view, but I want to talk about the issues with a little bit of nuance.
Pretend for a moment that I don't know what the Electronic Frontier Foundation is.
Okay, so they are a First Amendment watchdog group. I am usually on their side, right? They are usually aligned with the ACLU on free speech issues, and in particular on extending principles of free speech when it comes to communications over the internet, right? So, you know, we know stare decisis, we have certain precedents, and a large part of the game is, okay, well, you know, is this scenario like this scenario, right? Is reading the subject line on someone's email like slitting open an envelope, or is it like looking at the outside of an envelope, right? And so how you determine that determines substantively whether email protections fall on one side of the line for First Amendment or whether they fall on the other side of the line. And so they've done great work, right? I like the EFF on an awful lot of things. I disagree with them here. But I thought it was worth asking the question because they are by no means, you know, a right-wing hacky organization, right? They're well-motivated folks who do good work. I just think they're wrong here. And I should say, in their piece, they disclose that they intervened and worked with Defense Distributed. They worked with Cody Wilson. So their disclosure statement says Defense Distributed applied for the license with the U.S. government, and EFF helped advise the company at this juncture and helped it to get experienced export counsel. They have a dog in this fight. They initially met with and advised Wilson and his company, Defense Distributed. And, you know, and again, props to them for disclosing that. I don't think their arguments in this brief are very good, but I do want to clarify something from last week from episode 197. I don't think it's a crazy question to ask whether distributing CAD files is free speech. Okay. And if I gave that impression that it is a ridiculous question, that's not my view. My view tracks the view of the Fifth Circuit. And that is that the CAD files are not speech because they're purely functional and they're devoid of the communicative and expressive qualities that are characteristic of speech. So let me think about that for a second, right? Suppose I wanted to put up a mock stop sign with a bumper sticker on it that said Trump, right? So you've probably driven past in your neighborhood, you know, actual stop signs that say stop, and then somebody's put a Trump bumper sticker under it. So it then says stop Trump, right? That would contain, right? That obviously contains a political message, stop Trump. But if I were to go onto a street that doesn't have a stop sign on it and erect something that looks exactly like a stop sign, right? The government would stop me from doing that, right? They would say, no. Like we're gonna sever out the communicative aspects of what you want to do here. Right? Yeah. Stop Trump is a core First Amendment message. We're gonna protect your right to do that. But applying some version of the time, place, and manner doctrine, they're gonna be. But the problem is, you want to put up something that looks exactly like a government stop sign, and that doesn't have communicative value. That's just functional. That's meant to regulate traffic. And so, let's sever these two out and stop you from doing the thing that's going to prevent the government from controlling traffic on this street, and figure out a way to protect your right to talk about how bad Trump is. Apply that to this situation. Cody Wilson does not want to engage in a debate about the source code of the 3D printed guns, right? He said that, right? The communicative aspect of what he wants to do is his manifesto, right? He wants to, you know, stick it to the victims of the Parkland massacre, as we read on the show, and to make it impossible for governments ever to pass meaningful gun reform, right? That's his stated goal. And so his goal in circulating the 3D blueprints is not to have a discussion about, right? His goal is to undermine the law. In my view, it is directly analogous to sticking up the fake stop sign. That's my point on functionalism. I think that's the way the Supreme Court would go. But let me give voice to the other side, which is the Supreme Court has said all ideas having even the slightest redeeming social importance, including those concerning the advancement of truth, science, morality, and the arts, have the full protection of the First Amendment. Right. So if something has a scintilla of redeeming social importance, it is protected by the First Amendment. Now, being protected by the First Amendment doesn't mean you have a right to do it, right? It means that the First Amendment applies and then you have to weigh it against other considerations. But the argument here is that this doesn't implicate the First Amendment at all under the functionalist view. And it's not crazy to suggest that something like computer-aided design programming comes under the First Amendment. And the way in which you would go there is by putting forth evidence of similar functionalist speech that nevertheless gets First Amendment protection. And here, and I'm going to skip over a lot of the EFF's letter because it makes some stuff that I think is wrong and misleading. And it makes some, you know, kind of NRA-like arguments of, well, you know, there are other ways to make your own gun and stuff. You know, that in my view, it's just, you know, that's a public policy question. But I don't see how that's remotely persuasive, right? The idea that, you know, a skilled machinist could make their own gun, in my view, doesn't answer the question of whether we want something where, you know, a kid can just upload a program and print a gun at school, right? And the argument of, well, you know, you can't print the bullets. Like, I mean, it's a core aspect of firearm safety that you store your firearms and your bullets separately, right? And so, and many people, right? I don't know what NRA best practice is to have both under lock and key, but many people store their firearms in a locked gun closet and their bullets in an unlocked drawer, right? So kid gets a hold of a bullet. Yeah. It's a lot easier to print a gun than it is for a kid to get a hold of a gun. So public interest is really, really easy for me to define. And then there are these arguments. We'll skip over that. I looked at the brief that they filed, the amicus brief that they filed in the defense distributed case. The only case they cite in the Fifth Circuit that instructions like this are speech is a case called Herseg versus Hustler magazine. It's a 1987 case, and it involved an article in Hustler magazine that talked about, it was called Orgasm of Death, and this was a 1981 Hustler article about autoerotic asphyxiation. And in that case, 14-year-old managed to sneak a copy of Hustler. Boy, you know, not sure how that happened in 1987. And weirdly decided he was going to read the articles, read the article, decided to try it out, and unfortunately killed himself. And so his parents sued Hustler magazine for providing what they described as the instructions on how to engage in autoerotic asphyxiation. And the Fifth Circuit said, this is free speech, and they distinguished the argument in a number of ways, not the least of which is that there's not a whole lot of instruction that needs to go into how to engage, right? I mean, that the court's words, this is the Fifth Circuit, this is not opening arguments, and we have long said, do not take advice of any sort from this podcast. The court said, the manner of engaging in autoerotic asphyxiation apparently is not complicated. To understand what the term means is to know roughly how to accomplish it. End of quote. So, you know,
court's like, we all tried it and we,
yeah. So I will tell you, if that's your best case for why in the Fifth Circuit, right? And let me say, there are cases in other circuits about cryptography falling under the First Amendment, right? We could delve into it. But within the relevant circuit, if your best case is let's not hold Hustler liable for, you know, this story about a about a sexual practice, in my view, that is not a very close relationship to this case, right? There is clear communicative value, right? Like the whole point of writing the article was, hey, look, you know, more people than you think might be doing this thing. And as the court points out, you know, I mean, the title was Orgasm of Death, right? Like it was apparently not an endorsement, right?
Yeah.
It, as the court points out, they did not advocate the practice. Whereas there's no advocacy of any kind going on with the 3D printing instructions, right? Like it's not meant to engender a debate. It is meant to provide specific functional instructions. So I'm not persuaded, but I've been through and I did want to, you know, sort of give voice to the other side of the argument. It's not a crazy argument, but in my view, it's not a winning argument. And that's where I come out.
Well, fair stuff. Yeah, no, that seems to make sense to me. I don't see how those cases are really even that much related. I don't. It seems vastly different to me. But okay, well, we've got to thank our new patrons.
All right. So thank you to Tyler, to My Last Name Managed to Offend Even Tom, to LiveBaseballScorecards.com. Oh, I'm going to go check that out. Wouter Vermeyen, Stephanie Bennett, newly satisfied client of P.A. Torres, Brian Shilligo. Yeah, thanks. Robert Sharp, Kevin Wright, Anthony Steffensmeyer. Check out Journalism Podcast, Whatever Happened to Pizza at McDonald's. I don't know if that's the name of the podcast or an episode. That seems like you might run out of topics kind of quickly, but seems neat. Make Orwell Fiction Again. Good call.
Nice.
Nate Dixon's latest pickaxe estate tax conviction. And this pledge may only be used to buy McDonald's for Andrew. Well, this, I will record a picture of myself buying some McDonald's. I can always at least get a Diet Coke at McDonald's.
I want to point out that this is a $2 pledge. I mean, that means you need to go to McDonald's a few times a month here. So
there we go. All right.
I'll take the hit for you. I'll be happy to.
Oh yeah, you know, is it transferable?
Is it in your honor? Like, well, is it fee simple or is it? Anyway, there's a little law joke for you law fans, for you real property fans. Okay, and thank you to Mike Mahoney, an anarchist communist who wants to hear a lot awful movies. Ryan Null, Nicole Ricka, yeah, I think that's probably Ricka. Two C's? It could be Richa. I don't know. Nicole Ricka, Richa or something. Randy with a Y. And I like it because it's with a, like, W-H-Y. Randy with a Y, which I think is appropriate nice. For right now. Liam Smith, Earl Warren, Carlos Tirado, Andrew McFarland, the Butt Fumble Presidency. Jay Weiler and a deep fried cheese steak. Oh, cheese stick. A deep fried cheese stick. Both sound
both
good.
Both of those sound amazing. Yeah.
Maybe we get both.
I would crush a deep fried cheese steak right now, but I will take. There's a place on the Princeton campus that sells what they call the Fat Lady Sub, and it is a steak sub with fried mozzarella cheese sticks in them. Oh, it's so good. It's amazing.
Yummy. Anyway. Thank you guys, and I hope you enjoyed a lot of awful movies hot off the presses pretty recently, so go check that out for all your favorite Vin Diesel related law movies. There's only the one, so we captured it. All right, and now it's time to find out whether my string of nonsense made any sense, or, you know, maybe I got lucky and I blacked out like Will Ferrell in that one movie and just said everything right, or maybe am I like Will Ferrell? Or am I like Adam Sandler, where I said a bunch of stuff and then it all turned out to be nothing?
Mr. Madison, what you just said is one of the most insanely idiotic things I have ever heard. At no point in your rambling, incoherent response were you even close to anything that could be considered a rational thought. Everyone in this room is now dumber for having listened to it. I award you no points, and may God have mercy on your soul.
Okay, a simple wrong would have done just fine, but...
All right, Thomas. So this was a contracts question, but a pretty layered one, right? This was person A loans $1,000 to person B. They then go through, and person B says, hey, I'd like to pay on the 5th of the month instead of the 1st. Person A says, yeah, that's fine, but you got to pay by cashier's check. And person B says, oh, yeah, that's fine. And then subsequently, person A sells that debt to somebody else, to a bank. By the way, parenthetically, that's a perfectly valid thing to do, right? Like, you can sell debts to somebody else. This is how our debt collection industry works, right? So what happens is these huge debt collection firms will come in and will buy debt up pennies on the dollar and then, you know, hound you. And, you know, if they have a collection percentage that exceeds the value by which they purchase, then they make money. And obviously they make money. Anyway, so they sell out the debt and the bank says, hey, nobody told me about this whole 5th of the month thing. And we are going to inform you that your payments must be made on the 1st of the month. Can person B, can the debtor justifiably insist that the payment be the 5th of each month? And you went through an elaborate distinction in eliminating answers B and C between waiving a condition in a contract and just, as you put it, amending the contract, right? Changing what the contract says. So you use that to toss out answers B and C and to pick answer D. And I have to tell you, I've been sitting on this since our record. You analyzed this exactly perfectly. I'm going to upload the text for our patrons. And so you can see what the National Council of Bar Examiners had to say about answer D, which
is
your answer. Yes, because the creditor could assign to the bank only those rights the creditor had in the contract at the time of the assignment. Here's what I usually paraphrase and give my own analysis. Here's what the NCBE says. Okay, they say, correct. An assignee succeeds to a contract as the contract stands at the time of the assignment. In this case, the parties had modified the contract as to when the payments were due. Note that there was consideration for the promise to accept payments, right? And that consideration being
the cashier's check.
You have to make it in a cashier's check, right? So both sides gave something of value. Later, the consideration was the debtor's promise to make future payments by cashier's check. Accordingly, the debtor can insist that the payments be due that on the 5th of each month. And I'm not going to read the reasons A, B, and C were incorrect, but they begin with by pointing out that this is not the example of waiving a condition in a contract. The attractive distractor is waiving the condition was the first instance, right? So on February 1, the debtor says, oh, man, I don't have it on the first day. I'm going to have it for you by the 5th. And the creditor says, yeah, that's fine. And then subsequently comes up again. The debtor says, hey, I don't have it on the first of the month. I'm going to have it on the 5th. And the creditor says, yeah, look, we'll change it. You can pay on the 5th, but you got to give me this thing in exchange. That is not a waiver. That is a modification to the contract.
You're damn right.
100% perfectly. I am so proud of you. This was awesome.
Wow. I'm a real lawyer, everybody. I'm just going to do contract law, though.
not only did you get it right, but this is the correct answer that puts you over 50.
Right.
So you will be over 50% better than half.
No matter how many times I trip over my own shoelaces on the way to the end zone, I still got that 50%. That's good.
There you go. So congratulations.
Well, holy moly. I feel like I won this, but I feel like we shouldn't even do a winner, but no, we will. But it's second place. Hop in your time machine and find who got second place, because apparently I did exactly what the state, whatever bar of somethings that you said thought. So I'm awarding I'm using my privilege on the podcast to award myself the prize this week. So please shower me with never-ending fame and fortune. I'll appreciate it. Who got second place?
Meanwhile, at the Hall of Justice.
Well, Thomas, this week's winner is S.J. Harrison, that is at Shaded Spryder on Twitter, who says, I am going with B for TTTB since I think this is a waiver, not a change. So just an illustration, the difference between waiver and modification to a contract is something that that trips people up. And while this was an incorrect answer, it was definitely made in good faith. It definitely went to the heart of the issue. So everyone give, that's at Shaded Spryder, S-H-A-D-E-D-S-P-R-I-T-E-R. Give SJ a follow on Twitter, and congratulations for being this week's winner.
All right. Well, wow. I'm at 50%, guy. Well, I guess a minimum of 50%. I know, big number 50, I guess, is what I mean to say. But anyway, that was a great episode. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks most of all to our patrons for making the show happen. And we hope you're enjoying that bonus stuff, a lot off of movies and all that. And we will see you on Friday.
Yep, until then.
You betray the law! Law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is produced with the help of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, production assistant, Natalie Newell, and our unofficial researcher, Magpie. A special thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Natalie, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, and Emily Waters. And also thanks to Thomas Smith, who wrote and produced all of the amazing music you hear, which is used with his permission.